welcome to What Matters in North Carolina. My name is Mark Shiver. Glad to have you listening to the program today. And we're going to dive right in because we're going to talk about a topic that I particularly enjoy talking about, even though it's not something that is enjoyable to think about as a reality in our world. But we're going to talk with Lieutenant General Daniel Bolger. He is going to be the speaker at the next ICON Lecture Series event, which is coming up on April 25th. And I would encourage you to go out and participate with General Bolger. He's going to be talking about slow death, assessing America's war on terrorism. And as you know, the ICON Lecture Series, always a great outing, great event to attend. And for more information and tickets, you can go to ICON, I-C-O-N, LectureSeries.com. That's ICON, LectureSeries.com. And going to be talking with Lieutenant General Bolger and asking him about some of the things that are hot-button issues right off the headlines of today. What in the world is going on in the war on terror? What about Syria? What about North Korea? What about Russia? And on and on and on. So he is very expert in these matters. He is an author of 8 books, the most recent 2014 entitled Why We Lost, A General's Inside Account of the Iraq and Afghanistan Wars. Without any further ado, let's talk with Lieutenant General Daniel Bolger here on What Matters in North Carolina. It's a real pleasure to welcome to What Matters in North Carolina, Lieutenant General Daniel Bolger. He is going to be the featured speaker at the ICON Lecture Series coming up next week. That will actually be on April the 25th. And you can find out more at iconlectureseries.com. But that's going to be a very interesting evening in light of all that's been taking place in the world of terrorism and Syria and Russia and Iraq and Afghanistan and on and on and on. General Bolger, welcome to the program, sir.
Well, thanks, Mark. Glad to be here.
Your topic title is Slow Death, Assessing America's War on Terrorism. Can you give us the thumbnail of what that title means?
Yeah, what it basically means is we've been fighting terrorists and insurgents for a long time, and we don't seem to be getting anywhere. That's basically the bottom line.
Well, I think that's a sentiment that a lot of people would concur with, and we often wonder what the world's going on over there in that part of the world, and why can't we seem to make any progress? Do you feel like, do you have any insight that you can share with our listeners as to why we're not making progress in the war on terror?
Yeah, sure, I think I can. Well, of course, Mark, I think the thing most people need to remind themselves is that from an American point of view, we think this thing started in the horrible attacks on September 11th, 2001, when the planes went into the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, and the one crashed in Pennsylvania. But from the standpoint of the guys fighting us, our enemies, they just see this as another round in a millennia-long war between what they see as their view of the Islamic religion and the other world. You know, the true believers of this kind of twisted version of Islam say the whole world's broken into two parts. You're either part of the House of Islam, the House of Peace, following their religion and their Sharia law, or you're in the Dar al-Hab, the House of War. And if you're in the House of War, you're either going to be converted or killed. And we are in the second category for them.
Is it really that simple?
Well, it's simple to say, but of course, then you break it down to how do you deal with it, you know? Do we really want to go to war with, 1.3 billion Muslims? No, and we should remind ourselves that most of the victims of Muslim terrorism are, in fact, their fellow religion members. You know, that's who suffers the most. The people in countries like Afghanistan or Iraq or Yemen, they really take it on the chin, and their families are killed, their children are killed. I mean, that's something we always got to remember. You know, the terrorist attacks that occur here and in our allied countries, in Europe or others, I mean, are horrible, but it's a small amount compared to what happens over there.
Well, let's talk about that for just a moment, General. You know, we hear that it's often said that Islam is a religion of peace and that there are many, many adherents to Islam that are peaceful and just want to, you know, enjoy their religion and get along with everybody else. And yet at the same time, we are subjected to this notion of jihad, kill the infidels, kill the great Satan, and the violence that is ascribed to that part of Islam is horrific. Now, I don't know if it's normal or extreme, but what we've seen with ISIS, for example, beheading people and proud of it, putting it on the internet for the whole world to see, it's heinous.
Yeah, and of course, we need to remember that a lot of people they're beheading are people who also believe themselves to be good Muslims, you know, but they're not good enough for ISIS. I think the way I would say it is, you know, it's like the old Venn diagram. You know, these Islamic fundamentalist terrorisms are all Muslims, but not all Muslims are Islamic fundamentalist terrorists. But okay, there's 1.3 billion Muslims in the world. If there's 1.3 billion Muslims, you know, 10% of bad guys, I mean, that's millions. Or is it, you know, 1%? That's still over a million. You know, I mean, we just don't know. And people go in and out of that camp. They self-radicalize. We've had that happen in our own country. You know, it's not a predictable group. This isn't the German army wearing gray uniforms in 1944 where we can pick out who's the enemy.
Yeah. So, and to make matters even more complicated, you know, for example, and I'm probably going to just mess this up completely, but as I understand it, for example, in Iraq, you have Sunni Muslims and Shiite Muslims and all manner of different, I guess, strands is a good word, or variations, I should say, of Islam. And it's hard to keep track of all of that. And I would imagine that for someone like yourself who has served our country and others who are, you know, trying to fight the war on terror, sometimes it gets a little cloudy and confusing. Or does it?
No, it sure does. I think, Mark, that's a very good summary. Iraq itself, the name Iraq in Arabic means the split or the divide, because it was the traditional division between the two major Muslim groups, the Sunni, which are the majority, and the Shia, which are a minority. And, of course, there are several countries that are majority Shia, Iran being one of them. But, of course, the Iranians are Persians, not Arabs. So you get into ethnic issues, you know, Persians versus Arabs, Arabs versus Kurds, Kurds versus Turks. And then you get into these religious divides, the various shades of Shia and Sunni belief. And there are variations within those sects. Again, if we think of our own experience with Western religions, I mean, there's various belief systems within Christianity and Judaism as well.
Yeah. But none of which, apparently, at least not since the Crusades anyway, have, you know, advocated to and adhered to and committed the kind of atrocities that we are seeing in the name of global jihad.
Yeah, no, that's unique to this time and these guys. But of course, within living memory, I mean, we can point to groups that put on the mantle of various other religions and claim that was the reason they did something. These particular groups, particularly the fundamentalist elements, they've been around since the start of Islam. And, you know, even words in our language that we know well, you know, we talk about the word assassin, you know, that comes from the same root word as hashish, the drug. Hmm. You know, guys in the time of the Crusades, that part of the world used to get hyped up on drugs and then go kill people they didn't agree with. And, you know, that it's long been a strain in that part of the world.
So we started out by saying that the slow death assessing America's war on terrorism really comes down to the fact that we've been fighting this a long time and really not making a lot of progress. Is that accurate?
Yeah, and what I would say, Mark, is part of it is how we've chosen to fight it. Essentially, we're the premier power in the world by any measure. You know, whether you want to measure economic power, military power, power of information, you know, whatever you want to say, we're number one by a long distance. I mean, clearly there are competitors: the Chinese, the Russians, others. But yet we've chosen to fight this thing in places and ways that really favor our enemy. You know, we've chosen as a superpower to spend the majority of our time sort of wandering house to house in various towns in the Middle East, you know, looking at garbage piles to figure out which one's got AK-47s or high explosives in it. I mean, that, you know, that's not really the way superpowers need to be dealing with these kind of things.
So if you were in charge, how would the superpower deal with this kind of thing?
Well, I think, I've been in charge of parts of it, and I've offered this advice. Sometimes it was listened, sometimes it wasn't. You know, I'd remind everybody that when the United States fights its kind of war, like 1991 against Saddam Hussein in Iraq, the first war against Iraq, the so-called Gulf War, or the initial invasions of Afghanistan with our special forces, our CIA, and our air power in 2001, the initial invasion of Iraq, again, our great air power, our great men and women in the Army, Marines, you know, Air Force, Navy, Coast Guard, and our strong allies, you know, the British, the Australians, the Poles, all these other characters. I mean, when we fight that kind of a war, the quick lightning war, we're great at it, and we can smash the hell out of anybody.
Yeah.
I just don't, for me, as a soldier, former soldier, I don't understand the part where somebody decided it was a good idea for us to then hang around in these countries and, you know, try and, you know, wean them towards our view of the world. They don't want it any more than Americans, you know, wanted guys from London in red coats to tell them what to do in 1776. You know, people want to rule themselves, and they're going to choose their own ways.
Well, I don't pretend at all to be any kind of expert on history or warfare, but I really scratched my head, General, when the United States decided to get involved in Afghanistan when not so long ago the Soviet Union basically, you know, had to hang its head and retreat because you just can't win over there with the mountains and the terrain and people that are more than happy to have other countries, you know, come in there and try and defeat them. But their record is pretty outstanding against those types of things. And I don't know why the United States felt like, you know, we could do it any differently.
Well, we can be a little arrogant sometimes. I mean, the same kind of guys that, you know, we actually had Russians. The British Empire was there, and so the British were part of our alliance. The Russians came to us and warned us as well. We knew our own CIA and British MI6, had, as you pointed out, had worked there to help people fight the Soviet Russians in the 1980s. So, I mean, we knew it well. But we can get a little arrogant. I mean, we're also the same guys that when the French told us, stay the heck out of Vietnam, we said, oh, you know, you don't know what you're talking about. And that didn't go well for us either. So we can sometimes be kind of short-sighted. Afghanistan, you're right. I mean, it's reputation, graveyard of empires. I mean, it's an easy country to invade, but it's an impossible country to hold.
Yeah. So where are we today, 2017, April 19th? We've seen President Trump drop what is known as the mother of all bombs on ISIS and kill right many of those folks. Do you think that was a good move? Do you think that that has
any dead ISIS guys is all to our benefit and to the benefit of the people who live there, because those guys are nothing but trouble. I'm happy to see the use of that weapon or any other weapons that make sense on the battlefield, but we got to ask ourselves, what's the end? You know, those are tactics, those are events. You know, what do we see as the end game here? And there, even with the new administration, we haven't really heard the answer yet. So far, they're doing the exact same thing as their two predecessor administrations, George W. Bush and Barack Obama, in that, you know, we're sort of muddling through in Iraq, Afghanistan, and then some of these other smaller countries like Libya and Yemen. You know, we're supporting some guys who back us. We're not supporting other guys who we don't like. We're using our Air Force. And yet, you know, there's really no end that you could point to. I mean, if this is what we're going to do for the next, you know, 50 years, it would be nice if somebody would point that out, because I don't know that the American people have ever signed up for that.
Yeah, well, I don't think anybody signed up for this thing dragging on as long as it has. I think that, you know, we all remember very vividly President Bush standing on the aircraft carrier saying mission accomplished, and yet no offense to him, but here we are. Still in the throes of all of this. So let me ask you, if you can, General, to try to untangle Syria for our listeners, because Russia, I guess Soviet Union's not around anymore, but Russia recently dropping bombs over there, massive civil war, all these refugees, we're involved. Can you explain what in the world is going on over there, and what would the best outcome be for the United States? If there
sure.
is one,
I think the easiest way to look at it is Syria and Iraq, although there's a border there, that border was imposed by by European powers at the end of World War One. I mean, the people there don't recognize that border. They cross it freely and always have, you know, families and stuff like that, and also smugglers and you name it. And so what happened when we fought in Iraq in 2003 till the present, a lot of the guys we were fighting went across that border and used it as a sanctuary, a place to hide.
Okay.
When ISIS formed out of the remnants of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, you know, a force that we had fought, I mean, I can remember being over there chasing Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. He used to be on our target list when I was over there in 2009, 2010 for one of my times. You know, he's the same guy. He just traded in his ID card that used to say Al-Qaeda in Iraq, and now it says ISIS. And so these groups originally using the Syrian sanctuary and then determining that they wanted to defeat the Syrian government. Syria's government has long been an ally, and you were correct to say Soviet Union. That was their ally from 1946 until the Soviet Union collapsed in 91. The Russians picked up that alliance. Vladimir Putin is still carrying it out. And the government there is a small sect that's affiliated with the Shia. It's the Alawites. And so they have friends with the Shia Iranians, and they have friends with the Russians, because the Russians don't like Sunni Arabs or Sunni Muslims of any type, because they have a problem with the Sunni Muslim insurgency in the south part of their own country, the Chechens, for example. And so the Russians back the Syrian government, the Iranians back the Syrian government, and we, you know, we want to defeat ISIS, but the problem is we struggle to find allies. You know, there's not too many moderate Syrians after all these years of civil war. They've either lined up against the government, which generally puts them on the ISIS side, or they've lined up with their government, which puts them on the side of the Russians, the Iranians, and Bashar al-Assad's regime. And so there's no good answers. And the sad thing is, you see in places like Aleppo and Raqqa, the towns there, the average person is just getting hammered in the middle of this thing, and they're the ones who want out. And of course, the challenge is with them as they come out. You know, the wheat will come out, sure, but so will the chaff. And you get people in that Syrian refugee flow that are going to be fundamentalists and terrorists. And when they get out of there, they're going to continue to raise mayhem. And we've seen that in Europe. And if we're not careful, we'll see it here.
Well, it doesn't sound like that there's any kind of quick resolution to what's going on in Syria. And apparently, from what I've been trying to follow and pay attention to, General, is that we have to kind of watch what we're doing out of fear of angering Russia. Is that accurate?
Well, I think a better way to say it is, we need to remember, as we talk today, every day and every night, the Russians have hundreds, in fact, thousands of nuclear weapons still pointed at us. Okay, they may not be much of an economic power. They never were, even under the communists. But military is a different story. And they've got a lot of nukes, and they're still on missiles and in submarines and on bombers that are pointed at us. They just flew a few bombers past Alaska the other day, and they do that now and then just to remind us they still got that in their capability. So in the same sense that during the Cold War, we and the Soviets were very careful to avoid direct military confrontations. You know, things like the Cuban Missile Crisis were bad, but they were rare. We also got to think about it in Syria. That's why when President Donald Trump gave the orders to our Navy to fire those cruise missiles into Syria, we did warn the Russians. Because why? We didn't want to accidentally kill some Russians and touch off a direct conflict. So yeah, we do have to worry about them to that degree. We don't want a nuclear showdown with them. We definitely do want to let them know, though, that you know, they can't have a free hand over there.
Yeah. Well, what about North Korea? It sounds like to me that the leadership of North Korea does not have any respect at all for what has been this agreement that the United States and Russia, and I suppose China, to a degree, have adhered to, that says, you know, we won't bomb you if you don't bomb us with these, you know, nuclear weapons. And I think, frankly, General, if the folks at North Korea felt like they could get away with it today, they would fire one off at Hawaii before you and I hung up the phone. So how does the President Trump deal with somebody like that?
Well, you got to separate the North Korean rhetoric, which has always been extreme. I mean, you go back to 1945 when the Russians founded North Korea, and that's who founded it. I mean, the original invasion orders, when the North invaded the South to touch off the Korean War in June of 1950, they were written in Russian by the Soviet advisors.
Yeah.
So the Russians and the Chinese are getting what they didn't bargain for. They made an ally, and this ally is like Frankenstein's monster. It's taken on a life of its own. And so the rhetoric is always extreme out of Pyongyang, but you got to watch their actions. What are their real capabilities? Right now, whatever type of nuclear device they have or claim to have or claim to have tested, I would tell you is probably not deliverable. That's a very difficult step to get to. Takes a lot of integrated information technologies. Most countries in the world have never been able to do that. So let's assume for the sake of argument that they have that capability. In that case, yes, you're right, they would use it. But the key thing in North Korea is the regime survival. North Korea is the only communist country in history that's had a family dynasty rule it. The Kim Il-sung family, Kim Il-sung, the guy who launched the Korean War, his son, Kim Jong-il, who was in charge when the nuclear program really got going great guns, and then his grandson, Kim Jong-un, the current guy. And their key goal is regime survival. They would trade everything they need to trade to make that happen. But to make that happen, they're going to take ruthless steps. So they're faced by three superpowers, us, the Chinese, and the Russians. The Russians and the Chinese are often their friends. In fact, they still both have formal treaties with North Korea. But currently, they're making noises along the line. They want the North Koreans to behave themselves. Well, maybe. The biggest thing the Russians and Chinese want is no trouble on their borders, since they share a border with North Korea. If the North Koreans make trouble for us, I don't think that bothers anybody in Moscow or Beijing, regardless of what they say publicly.
Hmm. Well, that's fascinating, you know, because maybe I'm wrong, but I get the impression that President Trump would be more likely to engage with them than any of his predecessors. I'll put it that way.
Yeah.
You know, I think the fact that
I think you may be right. I mean, but we should be aware the United States has talked and attempted to talk to North Korea many, many times. I mean, going back to the final days of the Korean War, even, you know, right now, North Korea and the United States and South Korea meet every day in Panmunjom, right where you saw Vice President Mike Pence the other day. That so-called truce village started in the Korean War. And officers of both sides meet every day, primarily to work out and prevent, incidents along the so-called demilitarized zone, which is anything but demilitarized, by the way. I mean, it's one of the most heavily fortified borders in the world. But those meetings do occur. And I think President Trump, like some of his predecessors, is probably going to try and engage these guys. The North will talk if they think it's in their interest. But back to what is their interest? Their interest is survival of the Kim regime. That's the main thing they want. Anything that promotes survival of their regime is good. Anything that does not is bad. I mean, they will kill their own people, and they've done that by the tens of thousands. They will kill foreigners. They have killed their South Korean cousins in terrorist attacks. They've killed Americans. We shouldn't forget that. I mean, there's been an undeclared war on the demilitarized zone since the armistice in 1953, and there's been dozens of Americans killed there. Aircraft shot down. They sunk a Republic of Korea Navy ship about 7 years ago out in the west of the peninsula. I mean, they're very, very tough characters, and they will not back down easily. But by the same token, all that stuff about shooting a missile at Hawaii or whatever, I think that's rhetoric. They're not going to do it lightly. They will do it only if they think it's that or the end of their regime.
Well, that certainly sheds some comforting light, because it's easy to get the impression that this guy is just a loon and is itching for some type of, you know, nuclear conflict, which certainly I don't think would go well for North Korea. So, General, I think that you'll be speaking in Chapel Hill at the ICON Lecture Series, talking about Slow Death, Assessing America's War on Terrorism. And I went to the College of Charleston, and you received your commission from the Citadel in South Carolina. And so there's a little bit of a connection there. But I have to say, you Citadel guys were always kind of horning in on the girls at the College of Charleston. So I'm a little mad at you for that.
It's shocking, huh?
General, you've written 8 books. The most recent, Why We Lost, a General's Inside Account of the Iraq and Afghanistan Wars. I'll encourage our listeners to check those out, to check out all of your books, and also to make sure that they attend your lecture coming up on April 25th at the ICON Lecture Series. General, thank you very much for being our guest today on What Matters in North Carolina. We are going to put you in the Rolodex as someone to call on in the future with questions about the war on terror and other things that are happening in our country as related to stuff overseas and military and all of that. So if you don't mind, we'll keep your name on file.
Yeah, thank you very much, Mark, and thanks for these great questions. Great comments, too.
Great. Thank you, sir. Hope you have a great day. Boy, I could talk to him really for an hour. This sort of stuff has always fascinated me, and it's horrible. I mean, it really is. We've got war going on overseas in places like Iraq and Afghanistan and Syria, threats from North Korea. I mean, gee whiz, how do you untangle it all? And yet, I think General Bolger did a pretty good job of making sense of a lot of this stuff. And unfortunately, in 20 minutes or so, it's hard to really dig down and you know, grab that thread that holds it all together so that you can come away from a conversation going, oh, yeah, I really understand that. But he is the real deal, folks. And he has commanded troops. He has served. He commanded the 1st Cavalry Division in Baghdad in Iraq in 2009 and 2010. And his resume is certainly very extensive. And you can find out all about his resume and his credentials at iconlectureseries.com. Again, would like to encourage you to go to that website, ICON, that's spelled I-C-O-N, lectureseries.com, and avail yourself of tickets to the event on April 25th. And of course, ICON Lecture Series, always very good. Dr. Mike Adams, as you recall, was their guest in March, very well attended. Excellent time was had by all. So I am sure that General Bolger is going to be an excellent guest as well. I want to remind you also that the Civitas poll lunch is fast approaching. And if you've never been to a Civitas Institute poll lunch, you ought to check it out. It's interesting because, as you know, one of the things that the Civitas Institute does is polling. And they're very good at it, have quite the reputation of excellent polling results and outcomes in the past, and highly respected as a organization that does really good polling across North Carolina specifically. And the Holiday Inn restaurant downtown, I'm thinking restaurant because they've got a great restaurant. You know, the round Holiday Inn with the restaurant on top. Good stuff. But anyway, the location is the Holiday Inn Raleigh downtown. And that's Wednesday, April 26th. And you can go to nccivitas.org, click on the tab that says events, and get yourself a ticket right there. And make sure to show up. Again, it's 11:45 to 1, Wednesday, April 26th, at the Holiday Inn Raleigh downtown. And I went last month, and it was held at the same location, and it was excellent. Those folks there really do put on a good job, a good event. They, you know, make you feel very comfortable, and the staff and all of that is excellent service. And so I think you'll have a really good time. You'll get some good information on the latest Civitas poll, and go ahead, nccivitas.org, and sign up under the events tab. So that's two events next week, the ICON Lecture Series and the Civitas poll. Well, we've had quite the week here on What Matters in North Carolina. We talked with the chairman of the Republican Party, Robin Hayes. We talked with Republican Representative Burt Jones, and we've also talked with Dr. Sarah Stoneburner about whether or not optometrists should be performing surgery in North Carolina. And we just talked to Lieutenant General Daniel Bolger. So we're having a good week. Tomorrow, Friday, we'll end strong, I can promise you. As always, thank you for listening, and can't wait to talk to you again on the next episode of What Matters in North Carolina. Have a great day.